This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from the Mayor's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. We begin with a discussion about what in the world is going on with the selection of a school superintendent in Baton Rouge. And if you picked up your morning paper, the story is that there is perhaps trouble in paradise as finalists Kevin George and Andrea Zaya spent nearly 8 hours yesterday trying to persuade community members that they're the right choice to lead the East Baton Rouge Parish system. And representatives of three employee groups have issued an ultimatum. They're not happy with what has happened. And the two people, as mentioned, who will likely, one or the other, will be chosen by nightfall, is at the expense of Adam Smith, a 28-year veteran of the school district who made an early exit from the search. Some thought he was the favorite, but he is apparently out of the running. Another finalist withdrew and says found another job. So here we are, and with us to talk about it is Adonica Duggan, who has worked many years in school endeavors in this community. She is now chief executive officer at the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students. But she worked with a superintendent as his top person, Warren Drake. And Adonica, I think it's fair to say it's somewhat of a mess right now.
I think that's unfortunate, but yes, it's a little bit messy right now, and hopefully we'll get back focused on kids soon.
Well, what will happen when the choice is made? Doesn't sound like people will be happy no matter who it is.
Well, I think that's unfortunate. I think that also that, you know, it remains to be seen, but I'm hopeful that professional educators will understand the importance that they have for the lives of our kids and that they won't be deterred by who's in the leadership seat, and that they'll really focus in on making sure that, you know, on the first days of school, they're in front of kids mm-hmm. and the places that we need them to be.
877-217-5757 is your number, and talk at talklouisiana.org. And before we get to a discussion, I suspect Adonica knows some of these finalists better than others. But right now there are a lot of issues in the school system, as we know, and you have followed it intricately for a couple of decades. What's the biggest challenge right now?
I think the biggest challenge post-pandemic is literacy rates, and also the impact of absenteeism and truancy that we have. You know, we have a really casual relationship between families and schools in the community, and that shows up in the fact that less than 40% of our kids are reading on grade level right now in the city. And so, you know, whoever takes this job, and I'm super grateful that we have qualified, talented people who are willing to run into the firefight, but whoever takes this job has a big task ahead of them.
877-217-5757 is your number, and talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. And let's see here. It's Darcy asks about the St. George wrinkle. Is that a factor? We're still kind of sifting through to see what's going to happen. But, of course, that had a lot to do with schools, didn't it? The formation of that new city.
You know, I think it depends on who you ask if it had a lot to do with schools. I think originally, certainly, that, you know, that was one of the concerns of the folks in that part of the community. I will say, you know, we have right now ahead of us work for the next year or two that is, regardless of what happens with St. George and regardless of, you know, how those kids are going to be served in the long term, in the short term, they are the responsibility of the East Baton Rouge Parish school system. And we have to make sure that every child in the East Baton Rouge Parish school system is served well. And that includes right now, for the current moment, that part of the community.
But will resources be pulled from other areas and go to what is a predominantly white school system, which I guess would be the only one in the parish?
Yeah, I think that the difficulty of large urban school systems is always a resource constraint, you know, and I think that, you know, it remains to be seen what the separation agreement looks like. You know, I spent a lot of my career in Zachary, have a lot of familiarity with Zachary and Baker and Central and what those pullouts look like from the parish. But certainly, you know, we have to think about how we best use those resources to serve these kids right now. And, you know, what the separation agreement looks like is the work of attorneys and the work of the people mm-hmm. in charge of that. And that's not the moment that we're in right now. But, you know, it's definitely something that this school system and this next superintendent will have to contend with. And so they need to be adept in thinking about how to make sure that kids are best served and that the district is protected in a way that allows them to serve kids well.
We're hearing the voice of Adonica Duggan. She is Chief Executive Officer of the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students. This is a relatively new group. Tell us about what your group is assigned to do.
Yeah, we are a three-year-old education advocacy organization. It doesn't feel like it's been 3 years, but we turned three in March. We're an education advocacy organization focused on the needs of public school children in the Baton Rouge community. You know, we think that, you know, oftentimes in these conversations, we want to talk about everything except what's best for the students, and we help to refocus our school board members and our community on how do we make sure that the most underserved students in our parish and in our school system have what they need to be successful and to contribute to the lives that we want for them in this community.
How familiar are you with Andrea Zayas, who is the person coming this way from another place, but has great credentials and is one of the finalists, and Kevin George, who is right on the LSU campus at the lab school? Do you know much about them?
Yeah, of the 17 candidates that we had in the pool, I had relationships with quite a few, and that's what happens when you've spent 20 years of your career in public education. But I think that both of them, while I don't have like deep, intimate knowledge of who they are, is I've spent a lot of time researching them and understanding what their work looks like and what their comparable experiences look like. I think we had a really strong pool of applicants, thankfully, for, you know, a really important job in this city. And I think you can't go wrong with either of the choices that remain. I also think that, you know, this doesn't, not to speak ill of Mr. Smith, because this doesn't, you know, speak to his qualifications as someone who has played a critical role in the school system over the last 20 some odd years. Adam and I worked together when I was in the district, you know, and he and I have a great personal relationship. But I think that you have two really outstanding candidates right now, and I think that the school board's charge is to select from those candidates and to see this process through to the end.
Well, we often know that these decisions are made before the final vote, and they could be made tonight, but probably we won't know for sure until 5 o'clock Thursday, right?
That's correct, okay. Yeah. So tonight we have a two-hour interview with each candidate that is open to the public at the school board office at 1050 South Foster. People should come out. They should tune in. I think they're going to live stream those interviews and really weigh in with your perspective on those candidates with the school board members that represent you.
The two finalists, again, are the LSU Lab School director, a person known well in this community, and some would probably consider him the inside favorite, Kevin George. But he faces a candidate with exceptional credentials in Andrea Zayas, former chief academic officer for Boston Public Schools. And she grew up in New Jersey, worked in New Orleans for 5 years, but has a resume, as the Advocate reports, as an art teacher. She even opened her own charter school in Brooklyn. So she has impressive credentials. But as we know, usually in Louisiana, we choose people from this area when it comes to, and that's not taking anything away from Mr. George, but I would say he's the favorite, but he has stiff competition.
I don't know if that's necessarily, you know, the truth. I think that this board, based on our conversations with them, is really looking to see how these candidates perform in these interviews. Yesterday was a grueling day. I was there for all of it, bell to bell. And, you know, I mean, they also finished up with a dinner with the candidates. They took them to dinner separately with different groups of board members to really spend some one-on-one time or small group time to understand their perspectives and their vision for how they're going to lead. I don't know, you know, we've often seen, people have asked a lot, you know, does the pendulum swing in the opposite direction from having had Dr. Narcisse, who was an external candidate, to an internal candidate, and what does that look like? I think this board is really in a position to evaluate each candidate on their merits and to determine how they fit and who's best positioned to lead this district forward.
877-217-5757 is your number. Chris in South Baton Rouge. Chris, you're on the air with Adonica Duggan. Hi, Chris.
Yes, I think the financial constraints are a bogus excuse. I think that the more pressing concern for the area is parental involvement, specifically paternal. How can that be addressed? And I'll hang up and listen.
You know, I think this is interesting because it's something that we often hear. And I think the reality of the situation is, you know, I have four kids and they come from a two-parent household, and they're always going to be fine. And I think that the role of school in their life is, you know, important, but not critical. As we think about the way that our community is today, the vast majority of kids that we are talking about, particularly in a large urban school system, do not come from a home that has the level of involvement that my husband and I are able to provide to our children. And we can either throw our hands in the air and say their parents aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing for whatever the reasons are that we have arrived at that moment, or we can wrap the supports and services around them that we know that those kids need in order to be successful. We have for years mm-hmm. understood that kids who live in poverty or who, you know, come with different sets of experiences to schools have different needs. And as a school system and as a community, we're either going to dig in deep to really provide the services that those kids need, or we're going to stand around and continue to marvel at the problems.
Well, a listener asks about us getting sidetracked on other issues like the Ten Commandments in classrooms. Is that going to help the school system in East Baton Rouge Parish, or is that window dressing?
You know, I think that, you know, for those of us who spend our career in education, you know, the red meat issues of the day are not the things that, you know, families and caregivers are worried about for the children that are in their lives. And I think that we have all these questions about all of these things that aren't really consequential.
877-217-5757 is your number. Back in 89.3 seconds. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Adonica Duggan is with us. She is head of a group that's been around for 3 years, the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students, and they're involved in trying to improve public education in Louisiana. And right now, the leader of the East Baton Rouge Parish school system will be chosen this week. Chances are we'll know, some, at least the school board will know internally, by the end of the night who they're leaning toward, but the vote is expected this Thursday. But there is opposition. We will not be silent and we will not be complicit. Those are the words from Valencia Johnson, who's president of the parish chapter of the Association of Educators Teacher Union. And she goes on to say, we will not be there on August 8th if Adam Smith is not appointed as superintendent. Well, Adam Smith, the 28-year veteran, exited. What's the story behind that? Do you know anything?
Yeah, I think that, you know, five of the nine school board members voted to advance three other finalists, one of which has since dropped out. But, you know, we're in a moment where they had a process. Each school board member was to put forward their three finalists, and, you know, the top vote getters moved on, and Adam wasn't one among the top vote getters. And so, unfortunately, we're in a situation where now we are left with two candidates who I think are quality applicants, but who are not the applicants that, you know, the teachers unions would, you know, have advanced.
Nanette in Ascension Parish. Nanette, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I am a school teacher of over 20 years, public, private, and even parochial a little bit. But I was very intrigued with what your guest said just now about parental involvement. I know that it is the low socioeconomic that usually do not have parental involvement, but what about the idea of mandating parental involvement? I've even talked special education where the teachers are responsible for everything. Parents do not even need to show up for meetings. And I'll just listen off the air.
Yeah, you know, I think that we need to understand what the barriers are to families getting involved in schools. Often there are things like their own experiences with education weren't ones that they felt were positive, and so they don't feel like they are equipped to be a good partner in their child's education. We run a parent advocacy group and, you know, a parent training effort to help support parents in being good partners in their children's education. And we hear, you know, some of the challenges that families experience. And so I understand that, you know, this is a two-sided issue, but I think what we have to continue to do as people who have signed up to spend our lives making sure that children are well educated is understand what those barriers look like and help to try and remove those barriers and welcome parents and caregivers in to be partners. I've never met a family who didn't want great things for their children's education. I just think that all of us are equipped in different ways, and so we have to begin to understand what that looks like and what equipping those folks with the tools and skills that they need to do that looks like for them.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to get under the wire with Donica Duggan, and also talk at talklouisiana.org for emails. Now, this potential first day of school sick out, that would perhaps be unfortunate for the new leader of the system, who would be, I think, a victim. That's not a good way to start, is it?
Well, I think it'd be unfortunate for the new leader of the system, but frankly, I'm not really worried about the new leader of the system. Who it would be unfortunate for is the 41,000 kids in this school system who need great educators in front of them every day and who don't have a second to waste. You know, we have kids who need every bit of instruction that we can give them, and all of these distractions do not serve to better educate the kids of this parish and this community.
Mm-hmm. Again, 877-217-5757 for Adonica Duggan. Kevin in North Baton Rouge. Kevin, good morning, sir.
Yes, I want to know why the charter schools are doing so good, but when you have the teachers' unions picking somebody to come in and do something, they going to do just what the will is, because those people don't care nothing about the other community.
All right. Is Kevin onto something, or is he overplaying his concerns?
No, I think that, you know, there are great schools of all type. I think there are great traditional public schools. There are great charter schools. There are struggling charter schools, and there are struggling traditional public schools. And I think that, you know, we are past the point of having a discussion about charters versus district. And really, how do we make sure that we are aligning our resources to provide every kid in this community what they need to be successful?
Listener asked about New Orleans, which had a total revamping of its school system after Hurricane Katrina. And that experiment, according to some, is working, and it's not the traditional way of doing things. Can we learn something from New Orleans? Asked Tim in South Baton Rouge.
I think there are certainly lessons to be learned, both good and bad. I think that if you ask people in New Orleans, the reviews are mixed. But I think that pure performance-wise, you know, kids are better educated today than they were pre-Katrina. That doesn't mean that we don't have a lot to do better in Baton Rouge as we think about the lessons and applications. And I don't think that, you know, what we are looking to do in Baton Rouge is to replicate exactly New Orleans, because as we all know, for those of us who live in Baton Rouge, like, we are not New Orleans. Our challenges are different. Our city is very different. The composition of our city is very different.
Well, the teachers also have a say in this, and as they should, and they have a tough job. And I imagine the less controversy there is better for our teachers in East Baton Rouge.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, I'm hopeful that great educators are not going to make the decision about whether or not they choose to show up and serve kids on the first day of school based on who the leader at the helm is, because that's an adult issue. I don't believe that people who have dedicated their lives to doing this are not going to, you know, show up and serve kids well. And so I think that, you know, but certainly their voices need to be represented. Their concerns need to be heard, and we need to recognize that the single biggest thing that we can do to make sure our kids are well-educated is have a great educator in front of them every day.
Vera asks, would Miss Zayas be the first female? I remember Charlotte Plessy.
Charlotte Plessy, no.
Yeah, and of course, I thought she did a nice job and got a lot of grief.
They all get a lot of grief. I think that is universal in
true.
This job.
So who would want the job based on the fact that grief is going to be part of it?
Yeah, you know, I sat through the interviews yesterday, and, you know, I sat with a heavy heart for, you know, the divisions that I see this unraveling in our community. But I was grateful that great people continue to offer themselves up in service to kids. And I'm grateful that these people, I use this analogy with my sister this morning, that, you know, these are people who are like firefighters. They are running into the burning building and saying, like, I can do something about this. And I'm grateful that somebody continues to do that.
And Renee mentions that Cito Narcisse, he had the brass to actually try to get another job. And that didn't play well in Baton Rouge, did it?
It didn't. And I think that that's part of, you know, some of the difficulty of the relationship that Dr. Narcisse had with his board. And I think that, you know, he was looking for a level of comfort from them in terms of a contract renewal, and they were unwilling to give it. And so, like, certainly we are people who have to be thinking about how to provide for our families, but that did not turn out to be, you know, in his best interest in terms of relationships with his board.
And it's good to have Adonica Duggan in studio. She was here with Clay Young not so long ago and got rave reviews. And I've known Adonica for a few years, and I know she runs marathons, does triathlons. Is that still going?
Trying to burn off the crazy, yeah. try to get out of those. Came home from the long meeting last night and got on the treadmill. So
I know we talked about a year ago, and you had several years in a row in which you've run at least 1 mile a day, right?
Yeah, my run streak will be 7 November 1st.
7 years.
7 years.
7 years. Well, God bless you. We need to make Baton Rouge the fittest city in America.
We fittest and best educated are on my list. I'm here for it.
Last night I was walking through my neighborhood, and a gentleman with a dog and looked a little menacing, and I smiled at him. He smiled back, and he said, "I can bench press my weight."
I cannot.
But you can do other things. Doing a triathlon is not for the faint of heart, is it?
It is not. It is not. But it's something that I enjoy. I think it gives me a level of peace and balance that I need in my life. This is as I'm sure that folks who watched the coverage of yesterday's school board meeting can tell, it's a little bit of a stressful situation at times. And so it provides an important outlet so that I can be a good parent to my own four kids.
Well, we're going to take a short pause. We'll be back to wrap it up with Donica Duggan. Robin tells me we've got a caller or two trying to get in under the wire, so we'll keep Donica here for a few minutes. And again, if you'd like to get in, we'll give it a shot, try to get you in. 877-217-5757. We'll also hear Things Go According to Plan with Steve Mufson of the Washington Post. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and in short order, we will hear from Steve Mufson of the Washington Post. He covers the business of climate change and has a major story that affects Louisiana dramatically. But we're wrapping it up with Donica Duggan, who is a person who is a mover and shaker in perhaps the most important part of our community, our schools. She's chief executive officer of the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students. I know, Robin, let's take one call, and Stuart downtown's been waiting the longest. So, Stuart, you have the floor, my friend. Good morning to you, sir. Speak up, Stuart. You're not coming in. There you go.
Jim, can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
Oh, yes. Thank you, as always. Good morning, Junior. Jim, I'd like you to feature one seasoned African-American on your show who would have a much different take than your current guest. Take this into consideration. You have five white school board members who have absolutely no experience in the classroom dealing with at-risk, urban, disenfranchised, disconnected children.
All right. Well, the guest, by the way, is...
I am a black woman, yes.
So, Stuart, she is a person of color. But he does make a point. We have... a majority white board in a city that's about evenly, a parish that's about evenly split as far as white and black. And there's some people who I think justifiably have a bone to pick regarding that.
Yeah, I think there are real concerns around the redistricting effort that the previous school board undertook. And I think that, you know, we expect that that will be something that will be addressed by this current board. I think that there are certainly districts that, you know, could be in play for a transition. But I think as it stands, these are the people who are elected to represent this community, and the communities and constituents that they represent elected them. And, you know, they are the people who are in charge of making these decisions for us right now.
Well, I hope you'll come back soon, and we'll know soon who the next superintendent is. Thank you.
I look forward to it.
Donica,
take care.
Doug, appreciate you. Steve Mufson. Mufson is with us. He is the reporter who covers the business of climate change for one of the outstanding journalistic entities in our world, the Washington Post, BA from Yale in economics and political science. And Steve has covered this issue for the Washington Post since 1989. He's also covered economic policy, China, diplomacy, energy, and the White House. So he is a man of all seasons, and he shared a Pulitzer Prize for his climate change series in the year of 2020. His latest is called The Drowning South. And good morning to you, Stephen Mufson.
Good morning.
This involves Louisiana in a dramatic way, and you lay out the lay of the land as you survey the marshes that blanket the area south of New Orleans, stretching for miles. It is a remarkable show of force for industry, isn't it?
Yeah, a tremendous show. Almost 90% or so of the liquefied natural gas exports in the United States go out of the country through either Texas or Louisiana.
Isn't that something? And there have been lawsuits against the oil and gas companies for ripping apart the coast, and those are still pending. And, of course, many politicians are protective of that industry because of what it provides to our state. But it has a cost, does it not?
No question about it. I mean, that's what the heart of the piece is about. which is that all these plants that are exporting liquefied natural gas, they're exporting a fossil fuel. And yes, it's an important fossil fuel to many countries around the world, and you know, in Asia and in Europe. But the impact it has can't really be denied, and so that's what it comes down to: to forge ahead with a natural gas or not. And this is, of course, a big issue in Louisiana, where people from both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, are strongly in favor of producing more natural gas. But it does come at a cost, and the main export facility in this story is one that seems to be pretty aware of what the impact would be. It's built a giant steel wall around the facility to guard against rising sea levels, which could, you know, in a hurricane, come and really do some damage and perhaps hurt the facility itself and the surrounding mm-hmm. area, of course.
You note that a lone four-lane road goes south past a Navy air base, an idle industrial site, a coal export terminal, and a handful of storm-battered communities. Then suddenly a gigantic facility rises from the wetlands. Cranes dot the skyline. They hover over crews that are installing a jumble of pipes, pumps, storage tanks, and two 720-megawatt power plants, equipment needed to freeze natural gas into a liquid form so it can be shipped around the world. It might seem like a risky location for a $21 billion liquefied natural gas plant, given this region's ferocious hurricanes and sea levels that are rising faster than almost anywhere else on the planet. That's the setup. It is an existential threat, and unfortunately, we don't have many politicians in Louisiana talking about this. It's mostly journalists who often are discounted as being on the left side of the spectrum, and I don't think this has a spectrum. It is something that is just reality, and it has an effect on where we are and how we move forward in our community. Now, a listener notes accurately, Steve, that court decisions of late have certainly gone in favor of the industry, starting with the Supreme Court and moving down to federal courts in Louisiana.
Yes, no question about it. I mean, this is this is a tough nut to crack. It's if you're trying to stop one of these big companies, you've got your work cut out for you. Unlike, I should say, a lot of the rest of the country, where everything from the Keystone Pipeline, which I did a series about back in 2012, that was carrying crude oil, but, you know, more recently, natural gas pipelines in the Northeast to take some of the giant shale gas reserves out of the state of Pennsylvania and all over the Northeast. Those pipelines have been associated with big political fights, and you just don't get that in Louisiana. You know, there are two pipelines that are coming into this proposed plant, and there's hardly been a peep about it. And they run about 15, 17 miles each, and you know, from there they get shipped abroad. So it's a very different political environment in Louisiana than it is in much of the rest of the country.
Would this be tolerated in other states off their coast?
Well, you know, there are a couple. There's a facility in Maryland, actually, and the one that in the Pacific Northwest. But other than that, and there have been some proposed ones in North Carolina and Virginia. And there have been big political fights about those. But, you know, in Louisiana, things and Texas, things have moved along much faster. There are half of those plants are up and running already, and half of them are under construction right now.
877.
The United States, I should say, the United States has become the largest producer of liquefied natural gas in the world. So that's something else, too.
All right. 877-217-5757 is your number. And where is this industry going? Is it peaking, or is it still on the rise?
Well, I think it's peaking a little bit because the administration, the Biden administration, has put a pause on a lot of the projects that have been applying for permits. And I think that the volume of protests from the industry hasn't been as strong as it might have been a couple of years earlier, because I think they see a possible slowdown coming for this LNG export. But I think, you know, if the freeze lasts a very long time, then, of course, I think you'll hear more from industry.
Well, a story just last week, the Biden administration can't delay consideration of projects aimed at exporting liquefied natural gas while a legal challenge by 16 Republican-led states plays out in federal court. That's according to U.S. District Judge James David Kane Jr., who sided with the states, granting a preliminary injunction that puts the Biden administration's delay on hold. It was unlikely, however, that any of the projects would be on a fast track for consideration, as the U.S. Department of Energy said last week that it disagreed with the court's ruling and was evaluating next steps. So we have a collision of approaches here between environmentalists and industry, and we'll see where it goes. David in Atlanta, you're on with the Washington Post, Steve Mufson. Hi, David. David, you're on the air.
So you guessed. NASA has a satellite that can absorb the reflected infrared heat from the surface of the planet being absorbed by CO2 in the atmosphere. If you graph the temperature of the Earth from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution by decades, every decade, the more CO2 in the atmosphere that we put there, the hotter it gets. And furthermore, the oceans are absorbing the carbon we're putting into the atmosphere. It's killing the plankton, where much of our oxygen comes from. A minor decrease in the atmosphere of our oxygen could kill life on this planet. Now, my question for your guest is, what is it about Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Jeff Landry, and other Republicans who either don't understand science or they're more concerned about getting support from the fossil fuel industry?
All right. Well, John Bel Edwards was also, to a degree, not to the degree of the others, but a Democrat who lives in Louisiana and was our governor. He backed industry on some occasions as well. So this is not just a Republican-Democratic thing. But it does appear, Stephen, that the conservative side of the spectrum is more intent on moving forward with these projects. And by the way, Robin tells me we got to take a break. So if you can hang with us, we'll come back and spend a few more minutes with one of the top reporters in the world when it comes to climate change, Stephen Mufson of The Washington Post. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, your number 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Stephen Mufson, the reporter for The Washington Post who covers climate change with Ernest, and we are at the heart of the action when it comes to this issue that will affect the future of our state and by extension the future of the United States. We in many ways are the breadbasket for the country, and as Louisiana goes, the nation is affected dramatically. But Stephen, what about David in Atlanta, who made the case that Republicans on Capitol Hill and in state offices are more likely to be supportive of industry and to perhaps thwart any action to monitor what's going on with industry? Is that a fair assessment of where we are?
I think so. Certainly, and this isn't just on climate. I mean, members of Congress tend to be protective of the industries in their home states. This is a little bit different because climate is something that affects all of us, and the impact that global warming has is one that cuts across all sorts of industries and all sorts of people. This particular plant is quite near an area where sea level has been rising 7 inches since 2010, and that's a very fast pace. So yes, there are particular interests that we hear, But the solution and the cost of not having a solution is something that's going to affect all of us.
As you note, it's a $21 billion facility. Who are the major players in this plant?
Well, the way an LNG plant works is it gets commitments from major oil and gas companies. So some of the big oil and gas companies were ones like BP and Shell, Repsol. The company who's sponsoring the whole project is called Venture Global. Unlike a lot of companies that like this are based in the region, but this company is based in Arlington, Virginia, oddly enough. So the people running it are kind of finance guys. So that's a little bit different, but it seems to be working well for them, certainly from their point of view. This is a $21 billion project. It's one of the biggest infrastructure projects ever. And so that's something
ever
else.
In the history of the country. Right at our doorstep.
And it's one of four facilities that they're building in Louisiana, a couple more toward western Louisiana, and a couple more much closer to Baton Rouge.
James and Metairie, our final caller for Stephen Mupson of the Washington Post. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Jim. Thank you, and good morning to your guest. You know, denial, it's a horrible virus that seems to be infecting so many people in this country concerning climate change. Jim, there was a famous talk show host, Bruce Williams. He had an expression. There are two kinds of people in this world. With a hot stove, you tell them they're going to burn their fingers if they touch it, and the other group, they have to smell burning flesh before they believe it. Denial is going to damage this planet and to damage our species. Thank you, Jim.
All right. Well, thank you, James. James is worked up, but this issue, unfortunately, which is an existential one, doesn't get the attention that, say, the Ten Commandments in public schools gets. And right now, the whole country is fixated upon the presidential election. And a listener asked a good point. Is there a distinction between Biden and Trump as to who would take a different approach one way or the other on this issue?
Well, I think that head-to-head contest would clearly favor Biden from a point of view of the climate. He's been a major sponsor of a legislation last year that involved money tax credits for electric vehicles and for a lot of other climate-oriented projects throughout the whole country, solar, wind. So on that front, Biden is clearly the person who feels a bigger sense of urgency about this. You know, I think that a lot of people are slow to get on board and realize what the climate situation is. I had one person I was interviewing said to me, you know, maybe it's just that people have to wait until their feet start getting wet before they can be convinced to get out and do something about it.
Now, two different listeners, and we'll part with this, have implored me to ask you about the emissions involving these plants. There are some who make a case that they're better, that there is an improvement. Is that valid, or is the jury still out?
Well, you know, there are a couple of different points to make on that. One is that there are a lot of projects that need to qualify for restrictions on methane leaks, and that's been an important factor for the entire global natural gas issue, is try to control methane. The other part of the, I'm trying to remember what was
as far as the emissions and whether or not this is a panacea, we hear this term net zero. Is that real?
Well, net zero, it's not entirely real, because there are some projects that just really can't do that because of the nature of the chemistry involved in certain industries. But I think for that very reason, it's very important that people do as much as they possibly can. You do get to net zero in some other areas. I want to also say that, you know, a lot of people who think about this say that it's important in developing countries that they be able to emit more, have higher rates of emissions for these things. And, you know, this is a very tough issue because these are very, these are countries that need to do more. Their populations are growing quickly. But we really, you know, it's important to approach this with the costs, the climate costs that are involved.
Well, thank you so much. Hopefully we'll visit with you again soon, a man who does his job well on an important topic, perhaps the most important as far as the future of the world, Stephen Mupson. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And with us to round the corner and head for home is Theodore Richards, who is a fascinating person. Theodore is an educator, writer, philosopher, the founder of the Chicago Wisdom Project, and editor of the online magazine and podcast Reimagining. His work is dedicated to reimagining education, creating new narratives about our place in the world. He will be appearing at the Red Shoes this Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 10 to 4. Wendy Hirschman at 2303 Government, where Red Shoes is located, tells us that if you give her a ring at 338-1170, 225-338-1170, and tell her you heard about it here, you'll be able to register at a reduced rate. But Theodore Richards, good morning to you, and we're glad you're coming this way. Tell us about the focus of your address this weekend at the Red Shoes.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me. You know, I was listening with great interest to your previous guest talking about climate change, and I think that a large part of what I will be talking about is climate change and the question of sort of why human beings make the choices we make and how we perceive of ourselves and our place in the world, as you said in the bio. And the question I often have and that people often have is, why do we continue to do things that we know are destroying ourselves and the planet? And the answer to that for me is, at least in part, it's because the human beings understand who we are and make our choices and derive our values from the stories that we tell about who we are and our place in the world. And even though we may know through science, for example, that our practices are destroying the planet and making it uninhabitable, we've told a story that through the stories of the values of industrial capitalism, that we are fundamentally individuals and that we are not living in relationship with the planet as a living being. And so I think that the work that I'm doing and the things I'll be talking about are the kind of stories we have about who we are and our place in the world and how we might then reimagine what those stories are.
Why do we have this mentality about any number of issues? The budget, the deficit, climate change, you name it, education, poverty, of kicking the can down the road?
You know, I think it has to do, in a large part, if you look at sort of human civilizations and human cultures throughout our history on the planet, going back hundreds of thousands of years, for the most part, human beings understood themselves to be kind of enmeshed and entangled in relationship as part of community fundamentally. But if you observe what's happened over the last, say, 500 years, which is really just like a blink of an eye in terms of human history and certainly in terms of kind of planetary history, what we've created is a culture and a civilization that's rooted in the notion, and this is primarily through the capitalist system that we have, the notion that we are most fundamentally individuals and that our primary responsibility is to act in self-interest. And if we look at kind of like how corporations are structured, if we look at how our kids are taught in schools, they enter into a classroom to compete with each other.
Well, we do have to roll, unfortunately, but Theodore Richards will be at the Red Shoes this weekend. For more information, 225-338-1170. Until tomorrow, stay safe and stay tuned.